director John Badham has penned his second book, John Badham on Directing. The publication coincides with the 30th anniversary of Badham's films War Games and Blue Thunder, and the 20th anniversary of Point of No Return and Another Stakeout. The book is for directors and film fans alike and offers an engaging look at the psychological, technical, and managerial elements that go into helming a film or TV show. John Badham is a veteran of over 30 films, including War Games, Blue Thunder, and Saturday Night Fever, as well as many TV episodes. He supports his insights with true stories from his own directing career, as well as wisdom and anecdotes from leading actors, producers, cinematographers, and other directors. It is a great pleasure to welcome John Badham to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for asking me to be with you.
It's very nice to have you here. When you think of your life as a director, what do you enjoy about that role?
I enjoy telling stories, which is a constant challenge. Now, it's not like I'm telling the same story all over again. You know, I don't think I would enjoy telling Goldilocks and the Three Bears every day. But new versions of that, maybe so. And it's always interesting, you know, new scripts, new stories, new approaches to drama. Are we teaching something? Are we making people excited? You know, what's going on here and how do we do the best job? And that's a constant learning experience. I'm always learning from other directors, other actors, and just life itself.
When you are thinking of a project and deciding on what you're going to do, what goes into that decision? What goes into deciding that, okay, John Badham is right for this particular movie, right for this particular television episode?
Well, I certainly know my reaction to a script when I first read it is the most key thing of all, because if I don't really respond to it when I first read it, I think, am I ever going to respond to this? And if I don't respond, can I do a good job with it? So I know that a lot of the films that you've just mentioned of mine, when I first encountered the material, I was really excited. And Saturday Night Fever, I remember a temperature of 102 and a terrible flu, and I was out of bed and recovered within seconds of reading that script. That's because the characters excited me, the story excited me, and I'd never been to Brooklyn in my life.
And when you work on a film, and let's use Saturday Night Fever as an example, because it comes out, you're dealing with a young actor in John Travolta, and the film just explodes, takes on a life of its own, and becomes a cultural landmark. Obviously, it is impossible to ever replicate or duplicate that, but over the years, do you have an understanding of what it is that was so important about that film that caught people in that way?
Interestingly enough, I think what I just said about never having been to Brooklyn, and yet as somebody who was born in England and raised in Alabama, there's a weird combination, it spoke to me, the characters, you know, what the young guy, the young Travolta character was going through, what his buddies were going through. It spoke to me, and I understood them. And obviously they were in a different world, but there was a kind of universality to what they were going through. And now we add on top of that, you know, some very exciting music and dance, physical dance from John Travolta, not to mention a personality that was so electric on screen that, you know, people couldn't get enough of watching him. So it was an amazing, you know, coming together of many elements. I don't think anybody really appreciated that, except maybe for Robert Stigwood, the producer, about how well all this was working.
Every time you mention Frank Jr., you gotta cross yourself.
He's a priest, ain't he? Father Frank Jr., your brother.
Your mother doesn't have too much to cross yourself about these days.
You're so jealous of Frank Jr.
Oh, shut up, will you?
Hey! Where are you? Boom!
And a shirt. Wash the shirt, stupid.
Okay. Basta.
All right, come on.
Mangia, mangia.
Eat. Go ahead. Eat. I got more pork chops, more spaghetti.
What do you mean you got more pork chops? I'm out of work.
Yeah, well, as long as we got a dollar left, we eat good in this house.
What?
Yeah, I might even get a job myself.
Like hell you will. 25 years in construction work, I always burn him a paycheck. What, 6-7 months I'm out of work? And all of a sudden, what? You hit me. And talking back.
All right.
Talking about getting a job and hitting
me. All right. No hitting, no slapping at the dinner table. Okay, that's the rule. Hmm? And you was the one who's hitting.
I was fascinated in the book by reading your recollections about making Blue Thunder.
I thought it was illegal to arm police helicopters.
Well, that would depend on the circumstances, wouldn't it?
A lot of people ain't gonna like this.
What do they call that thing, an air buster?
It's special. Somebody hung a nickname on it.
What?
Somebody hung a nickname on it.
Blue Thunder.
You start off the chapter by saying you want to know how not to do an action scene. And you go on to tell a story about watching this director's cut of Blue Thunder, which was a very expensive movie for early 1980s, 1982, which it came in over $25 million. And what did you learn in the making of that film when it came to making a big budget action movie?
Well, it was definitely the biggest action piece that I had done and the most extensive. And I thought I understood it pretty well until I got deep into it and learned a lot about shooting action from John Alonzo, the cinematographer, how to be able to break all of the storyboards down and so on. But the biggest thing that I learned was that having, you know, chases and explosions and action fights and things like that is not nearly enough. Each one of these events has got to have its own little beginning, middle, and end. Stories like, let's say, Indiana Jones, the first Indiana Jones, when Harrison Ford is trying to escape from that cave where rocks are rolling down on him and big iron stone slabs are threatening to kill him. What's brilliant about that sequence is you know exactly what he has to do. He's got to get out of there. And then Spielberg and George Lucas keep putting obstacles in his way that prevent him, and each one makes the sequence more exciting. And what I had not done in Blue Thunder was I didn't have enough obstacles and challenges and problems for Roy Scheider's helicopter to get away from this SWAT team that was chasing him. And so our four-minute chase that I thought was so exciting actually turned out to be boring because it was just helicopter by, you know, gun, 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 more helicopter. And so we just kept trimming it down until we got it to like a minute and a half, where we did have just enough story there, just enough incident, adventure to make it exciting and alive. And that lesson has sat with me for quite a long time now.
The other film that you did that came out that same year, 1983, was War Games. And
yes.
Starred Matthew Broderick, and continues. I saw it recently in preparation for this interview, seeing it again, and realized just how important that was to me growing up and continues to be such a wonderful film.
What is the primary goal?
You should know, Professor. You programmed me.
Oh, come on. What is the primary goal?
To win the game.
There is a sensibility and a sweetness to that film that almost seems to be something that you bring to much of your work.
Well, I don't know quite where that comes from. I guess it's speaking to my personality inserting itself into there, because it's possible to tell that exact same story from a much darker point of view, from the point of view of a young man who's very troubled emotionally with a family that doesn't understand him, and he's locked up in his bedroom. I mean, we've heard this story many times since then, have we not? Of, you know, young people who are so, you know, at trouble with the world. And yet I kept thinking, you know, this is really funny. This is very funny what's going on here. Here's this young kid who's gotten himself in way over his head because he wants to play games, and he's a playful kid. It's really very charming what's going on here. I don't get a sense of this kid rebelling against the world. I get a sense of this kid wanting to be, you know, a young teenager who just loves to do devilish things and get himself into a little bit of trouble because he can. It's fun. And I kept thinking, boy, if I could have broken into the school's computer — my school didn't even have a computer, they didn't know what a computer was — and I could have changed my girlfriend's grade in biology to an A, I would be peeing in my pants with excitement as to how terrific that was. And I thought, that's very funny. So I did approach it with that, and we were always looking for humor in that film, even down to the way his father butters his corn.
Which I still do to this day. I learned that from that film.
I know. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
You butter the bread, and then you use the bread to butter the corn. It makes a lot of sense.
Now, you'll love where this idea comes from. I don't know that I've ever told anybody this idea, but Walter Parks, who wrote the script with Larry Lasker, he and his partner were doing a documentary as, you know, young film students. And the documentary was on the American Nazi Party. And they went and they talked to a man who was the head of the American Nazi Party. And while they're talking to him about the horrendous subjects that you'd talk about with somebody like that, he's sitting there having lunch, which includes corn on the cob, that he's buttering in this particular way. The source is kind of grotesque, you know, but again, it's just very funny. It's just so ironic.
And the father in that film just does it so nonchalantly, and you are there watching the film saying, oh, well, that makes perfect sense. That's a lot of fun. And it also gives some background to Matthew Broderick's character.
This corn is raw.
I know. Isn't it wonderful? It's so crisp.
Of course it's crisp. It's raw.
No, it's terrific. You can just taste the vitamin A and D in here. It's great.
Could we have pills and cook the corn?
I've heard you described, and you touched on this a bit, but I hear you described as an actor's director. I'm curious as to what that means to you.
It means to me that I think of actors as my creative partners. I don't think of them as puppets or meat, as I've heard them sometimes described. Bring in the meat, or let's just have these puppets here. And many, many directors would like to think of their actors that would be that, that compliant, just to be able to be molded like that. But I'm looking for more. I'm looking for what the actor brings to it, what ideas they have. I'm always getting great ideas from actors who've thought about that script almost as much as I have and bring their own sensibility. I think it's a big mistake to think that you're the only person that has any good ideas and everybody else has to bend to your will. Of course, you as the sort of captain of the ship have to try to decide what are the good ideas and what are the less good ideas and which ones to ignore totally. But at the same time, with that little bit of open-mindedness, you can get all kinds of wonderful ideas from your actors. So I go to great lengths to bond with them, to get to know them, to let them know that I'm there for them, that I tell them that failure is okay. Failure is just fine. And by failure, I don't mean showing up drunk or not learning your lines. I mean failure in the sense of, I got an idea. I'm going to try this. Mm-hmm. Uh-oh, it didn't work. Oh, well, it's okay. We'll go back to something else. And until an actor trusts a director, they're not going to try that. They're going to just rely on their safe old things that always get them through, and they're not stretching themselves. When they trust a director, they'll metaphorically throw themselves off a cliff and, you know, see if it works, because they know the director's there to catch them.
When you look back at your career, both in films and on television, what are you proud of? What are you proud of that you accomplished?
Gosh, I think stories that still hold up when you watch them, and certainly having a lot of fun along the way. Everybody, we seem to look at the sum total of a person's career as what their achievements are, their awards, their big plaques and statues and stuff, and what's neglected is, what was the process like? How was the person doing in the process of making this? Were they, you know, enjoying it? Were they following their bliss, as one person put it? And that, you know, I think is so important and often neglected. We're looking at just, you know, results and praise and so on, but the whole process itself is a very critical thing to enjoy. And, you know, what was it like while you were doing it? Were you enjoying it? Were you loving what you were doing? Was it challenging? Or was it a big bloody bore and you just kind of went through it because you had to go through it and you had to make some money?
Well, it's fascinating reading about the process in this book and about your successes and even some of the things that were a bore. It is John Badham on directing. It is a great honor and a pleasure to talk to you, sir. I thank you very much, and I appreciate you spending time with us this morning.
Oh, great. Well, it's fun talking to you, Joe, and look forward to doing it again sometime.
I as well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, John Badham on Directing, Notes from the Set of Saturday Night Fever, War Games, and More. The book is published by Michael Wise Productions. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.